Hello, everybody. Chris Martinson here. And today we're going to be talking about finance and economics as part of Finance U. Remember, anything that you see in this video and all resources available at our websites or affiliated websites are not intended as or construed as financial advice. This is for educational purposes. Remember, if you have a financial decision, please consult a financial professional. We are not attorneys. We're not CPAs. We are not financial managers. As well, we do our best to be accurate, and everything we represent is as accurate as we know it to be. Now, let's turn to our program. The United States is about 30% of all the debt in the whole world is housed in this country. And so that's a big mountain to dig out from under. Either way, it's really painful, but we shouldn't have been here. Markets should have set the interest rates, and we wouldn't have gotten here if we had honest money. Hello, everyone. Great to be back with you all here, all you wonderful, beautiful listeners. We are here at Finance University with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Paul, so good to see you.
Good to see you today as well, Chris.
All right. I have a question. Why is it different this time?
That's a wonderful question. Why is it different this time? Well,
it must be because, you know, look at all these. We have these charts of parabolas on all kinds of different stocks and assets, right? But including, and as we talked about last time, sorry to blindside you with it, but Abercrombie and Fitch skyrocketing, looking a little tulipy, if you catch my 1637 drift, you know, from Holland, right?
Yes, it is. Well, I mean, we've got this melt up and it seems like YOLO is back right now, right? I mean, you've got Germany's in recession, which you've talked about that, which you'd be proud of me. I'm starting to follow Germany a little bit now.
Good.
When it's on our radar, I follow it closely, but I can't help it. But the DAX is at all-time high. You've got Japan in recession, but no worries. The Nikkei is at
40,000.
Yes. Yep. The UK's in recession, but no worries, Chris. The FTSE's at all-time highs, right? NVIDIA beats by $2 billion, okay, and added $280 billion in market cap. So I just did a little quick calculation. So if NVIDIA beats by $2 billion a quarter, it'll take 140 quarters or 35 years to catch up to the market cap increase for that $2 billion beat. That's insane.
I have to ask. I have another question. Is that a long time?
That's a long time. You know, for the average person that retires at 65, 35 years puts them, you know, closer to 100. And that's a little bit beyond life expectancy, except for those of us who live, I can't say us, those that live ridiculously clean, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, here, let me look. Keep going.
Here's kind of what I wonder if it's different this time. I mean, to an extent, it's always going to be slightly different this time. And all the new participants that are managing money, you know, that's getting money in their 40s, these economic cycles continue to go. But something that are continue to roll throughout history, something that could be happening is with all the excess liquidity still left in the system from all of the money that was printed, injected in 2020, and then the Fed's panic turn back in 1st of November, now I said October or end of November last year, is the herds maybe trying to front run a Fed intervention to stave off a recession. I mean, we've got a lot of the economic indicators are not anywhere near where the markets are, but the markets are just predicting that, hey, everything's going to be okay. So, you know, are we going to end up in a situation where at least initially in the U.S., we end up in a recession and the markets do like Germany? You know, the speculation is so severe that the Fed's going to bail us out, that we continue to make all-time highs in the midst of the onset of a recession? It's a real good question.
Well, is it Dow 50,000 with bread lines are going around every corner? You know, do we have a complete disconnect from markets to reality? Or is it more the case that the markets are just feasting still on all that liquidity that got dumped in? We know something happened in November of 23, but let's rewind. I mean, there was $20 trillion of combined central bank printing for COVID. That's a lot to digest, don't you think?
That's a tremendous amount. And it's still sloshing around the system. I mean, obviously, we've not had enough deflationary impact to remove some of that excess liquidity from the system. Now, people are spending it, right, as far as their increased cost of living. And that's one thing we had talked about before in the past is, you know, the question is, what am I hearing from people? the most consistent conversation that I'm having with everybody across the board right now is how ridiculous their food costs are and how much that has increased.
They're bad. Yeah.
And I've got a client that's really good. We had our annual review yesterday, and she's probably the best budgeter of anyone that I work with. She just tracks everything. And her and her husband were having a debate that it's actually as affordable to go out to eat now as it is to go buy your groceries and cook it at home. And she said, am I crazy? And I happened to see a chart that I was able to find yesterday on that other computer that I was pulled up that shows it's, you know, even if you're eating healthy, it's nearly the same price to cook at home as it is to go out to eat now.
So it's shocking, right? You know, you can get a little bag, a couple handles of groceries, and you're well over $100 now. You know, nothing fancy either at this point. So it is shocking to everybody except maybe Paul Krugman, who I don't believe has been in a store since 1983. He's so useless at that stuff. But let me show you, this shocked me because, listen, if it turns out households are no longer important, that it's just robots building things for other robots to buy and humans are superfluous, otherwise, we know that the consumer is at least 70% of the economy. So let's talk about the consumer real quick, because look at this. This shocked me. I was not prepared for this. This is interest payments by U.S. households, and it's mortgages in that big tan bar graph thingy, and non-mortgage is the black line. So people are now paying more in non-mortgage interest than mortgage interest. Mortgage interest has always been the big nut, and look at that spike. That's where the Fed started raising interest rates on that black rocket ride right there. The Fed absolutely is screwing over household budgets at this point in time, first by keeping rates too low for too long, and then by pulling the rug out. But look at the impact of that. That I found this shocking.
I never would have guessed
that this had happened. But look at that.
That's amazing, and that's a really good chart. That's something that intuitively I would have known, and I've seen it in different charts, but not overlaid like that. And, you know, and it makes sense as I'm sitting here thinking about it, when people are going and buying $100,000 cars and leveraging themselves to the hilt that 8-9% interest right now, plus credit card balances are high. You know, wow, that's no wonder the consumer is slowing in different areas. I haven't uploaded the chart yet, so I need to, that just reminds me of this, retail sales less food services. Let me see if I can share the screen here. Bear with me. It's going to show the whole screen, but I'll adjust it around just a little bit. Can you see that there, Chris?
It's coming up. Give it a second. I got the three little dots dotting away. I think it's still uploading.
Okay.
I'll let you know when I can see it.
Okay, perfect. But what it's pointing out is U.S. adjusted retail sales less food services is been contracting since 2022. So if you can see that there, you can see how that's been contracting since 2022. Now, this came out of the Mad King's titled "This Is Not Random" article published March 3rd. And again, you take a look at some of the other areas when you get in here, if this will bring this up.
So retail sales. So that's retail sales is everything, and apparel, sports, all that kind of, just retail sales, less food services. I guess we want to take food services out because that's got extra inflation in it or something, or.
Yes.
Or it's just, so basically, it's its own thing.
The point being is adjusted retail sales, less food services being something we don't necessarily need, right? We need food. So if we take food services out of there, then that gives you an indication of where people are spending. And you can see that that trend was already starting to decline a little bit. But this is surprising when you look at the markets breaking out to all-time highs like they are across the board. And I understand that the markets are not the economy, but this gives you a good indication of where the consumer is, and they're feeling that pinch from higher interest rates across the board. So you see that in the data when you show a chart like you did prior.
Well, look at that. Even back in 2000, 2001, we had that bad recession. It barely dipped down below zero there.
Yes.
And then, of course, we have the great financial crisis. It dipped way below zero. So that was pretty painful. Then we have the COVID.
Mm-hmm.
No, is that? Yeah, that must be COVID, I guess. 2019-20. Yes, that's COVID.
That was the COVID. But that was the lockdown, but basically.
It's in danger of dipping below zero again. So
correct.
Yeah.
And there's got to be some reversion to the mean. But on the other side of that, here's another one, which is the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index. So what's fascinating is you've got these markets breaking out to all-time highs, and the small business optimism is below, you know, and it has been since 2022, below where we saw it back at the bottom in the COVID initial lockdown, and well below what we saw from the 1980s to 2007. So that's an indication that small businesses, you know, even though the markets are doing great, maybe they're making ends meet, but they're having a hard time finding employees. Inflationary pressures are all over them. And then corporate competition and corporate political gaming through the legislative process is crowding them out. And, you know, so these are just little warning signs underneath the surface.
Yeah. I have another chart. So I do these scouting reports for my subscribers, and I know you see them, but I just wanted to let other people know what we're about to look at. And I have a few charts that from the one I put out yesterday. I'm just exploring the markets in general. And I came across this one chart I'd love to get your take on, because I looked at it. I don't quite understand it, but it seemed important. And it's this one. Oh, here, let me supersize this for everybody. There we go. So S&P relative to the consumer price index. So it's saying here that you know, how many points different between, I don't understand how this is constructed, to be honest, but it's an interesting thing. I'd never seen it expressed this way. And it basically says when you hit certain, however this is put together, when you hit certain levels like 1929, you had this problem. 1970, it took a long time to go for the S&P to get back. If you bought in 1970, it took a long time for you to get back to even. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. If you bought in 1999, it took you a long time to get back to even. And here we are in 2024. And so my question is, how is it different this time?
I don't believe it is different this time in the big picture or in the economic cycle. I don't. You know, the difference is, the only difference that I see in that chart there and what my assumption is this is either a ratio to the consumer price index or this is relative, you know. But I would phrase it another way if this was the S&P adjusted for the consumer price index. But the market reached an all-time high in 1973 before the big collapse of 74, because there was a lot of euphoria. But based on that chart, you know, the market peaked on an inflation adjusted term in 1970. So that may be some type of inflation adjusted term. But no, you know, and one of the things you look,
it's in points. So my guess is that it's basically saying, look, if the market went up 5 points, 5%, but inflation was 5%, that's a zero. So
it's
looking for those moments where you know, I that makes sense, because that's how I do housing as well. Like housing should always basically be the cost of rebuilding a structure, which is inflation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you could say if a house suddenly, you know, if inflation was 5%, but houses were going up 20%, it would be going way above that mean line, that inflation line, you know, and then you would say, oh, that has to revert at some point because you could build new houses. I think that's how that is. So anyway, sorry, keep going.
No, that makes sense. Well, one thing is you've got the trend line that they have in place there. That's that black line.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just stand back and look at that from the big picture, there is some cyclicality to that chart, right? It's going to be well above the trend line. It's going to get a little bit below above the trend line. And there is some rhythm in there, like cycles to the season. And that comes back to the reality that even though, yeah, technically it's going to be different this time, this is not different this time, because this is the basic human nature that we deal with throughout history, where, you know, greed overcomes fear, leads to speculation. I am concerned in this environment, Chris, which tops are impossible to pick, right? You just can't. You can gauge the risk of the market. You can lower risk in a risk managed strategy when the trend turns and you have decision points, but it's never going to be perfect, right? There's going to be false breakdowns and there's going to be false breakouts. My biggest concern here is you've got a Fed that has crossed every boundary since the Great Crisis in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an administration that's willing to raise our national debt $1 trillion every 90 days. I mean, $1 trillion every 90 days.
Yeah.
And call it the Fiscal Responsibility Act.
Yeah.
Oh, 100 days.
There it is.
100 days. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's really dumb. Like,
I couldn't help but you know, give my opinion about that. I think this is really dumb.
It is so dumb. It is so dumb. But my concern is it has trained, like Pavlov's dog, market participants that, hey, the Fed's going to bail us out. They're going to do whatever it takes, even if that's, you know, helicopter money. They're assuming, because they were able to get away with it prior to 2020, that we didn't have inflation, that the same thing is going to take place, and that this is just going to be party on with no consequences whatsoever. I think people know enough about history to where the leaders are afraid to get up there and say, we have reached a permanent plateau, like they did in 1929. And so they may not say that now. My concern is that we're going to break every valuation record throughout history, and that this thing is going to, you know, go far beyond what anybody anticipated. And the higher it goes, the more people that are sitting on the sideline have that risk and temptation of just throwing in the towel and just jumping in with the herd. And inevitably, when we look back at, you know, several years down the road, it's going to be terrible timing, but it may feel great here in the short run.
Yeah. I'm shocked by some of these things that I've seen of late. And so let me pull this one up, because I also put this in my report yesterday, but I did want to see what you thought about this, which is, so I just ran a little screener, you know, stock screener, and I'm looking at price to earnings multiple. So I set the screener. I said, just show me everything with a price to earnings of over 200. Now, this can be queered a little bit, because if a company has really bad earnings, it can drag that PE ratio down pretty hard. Yes. It drag it up pretty hard, because, you know, if you earned a penny, and this doesn't show any companies that have negative earnings, obviously, because it doesn't pass the screen. And then I said, now sort them for me by market cap. And we, right on the top, Advanced Micro Devices, part of this big, like NVIDIA, all this stuff. Here it is. They have earnings. They didn't have a bad earnings, but they have a PE of 384. Paul, I get the idea that we're pretty excited about technology and semiconductors, but should I wait 384 years for this company to earn my dollar back?
Yeah, that's terrible. I'm thinking that the investor that's patient enough to wait 4 or 5 years until this is over may be able to buy it at a lot better price than those who are chasing that right now. And that reminds me of these bidding wars that took place in houses. You know, you think people have these bidding wars that took place in houses and driving these prices up like crazy. We're starting to see reports of a lot of those have been very foolish decisions when we're looking back over the past couple of years. And the large majority of the markets in the U.S., can't think of specific dollar amount examples right now, but there's several reports of people that are like, yeah, you know, ran a $600,000 house to $1 million and I can't get anybody to buy it from me for $500 right now. Select markets for sure, not nationwide, but you know, the markets move so much faster with gamma squeezes and Wall Street trying to fuel it and the media behind it. You know, it seems more than the average market participant can take. They just want to buy in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know commercial real estate in terms of office in cities is doing terribly right now.
Yes.
Free fall. Like we don't even, some of it's going bidless at this stage. So we don't know what the actual value is at that point. But this again, this is the monetary vandalism I keep talking about, right? So I don't know, like if you read the original Federal Reserve Act, 1913, which I've done, it's not that complicated. They used to write these thin little laws, you know, 10, 12 pages, you could get through the whole thing. Now they're 3,000 pages, nobody knows what's in there. You know, who knows? They might pass an omnibus spending bill and do away with your gasoline reserve storage like they just did in New England. I don't know what happens, right?
I was shocked about that. We can come back that. I was shocked.
Stupid
can we be? How stupid can we be, right? Like, just give up our reserves. Like, we need no savings, right?
No.
Mom and dad's going to bail us out.
Yeah, we don't need any buffer, nothing in savings. We don't need a national strategic petroleum reserve. We don't need anything. We need none of that. We need more poor people from other countries to flood in an uncontrolled way, right? That's the path to success. No, we're under attack. That's my view. I can't. Yes. We could say this is dumb, but you know what they say, right? Mm-hmm. Once is dumb, twice is really dumb, but three times is enemy action, right? I'm paraphrasing, but
yes.
Yeah, it's like we flip this coin 50 times and it comes up head every time, we probably ought to be starting to think it's not a fair coin. Mm-hmm. You know? That's where I'm.
I don't want to change the subject, but I do want to ask you this question. Is it true, because I've not had the time to go actually research this, I've been watching the market so much, that every illegal immigrant that crosses the border gets an EBT card, food stamps card, with a substantial amount of money on it? Do you know if that's true, Chris?
I've heard it's true. I've seen that they are getting them. I do know that it's vaguer than you would think, right? Okay. We should have answers to that. But somehow the migrants cross the border, mm-hmm. and they're put on buses or planes, right? Those have costs all on its own. Having a bus ticket or a plane ticket obviously has a cost. And we know that they're being housed, and we know that they're being fed, and we've heard that they've been getting these EBT cards, right? Now, I haven't actually seen examples of that myself, but by the time you're already moving them, housing them, caring for them in terms of healthcare, probably makes sense that you're feeding them too, by hook or by crook, EBT card or direct. But then we had that report, not to stay on the subject too long, but that the Biden administration had flown 320,000 illegal migrants from other countries into the United States so they wouldn't have to go through that journey. 320,000. So what does a plane ticket cost? I don't know. $500?
Yeah. It's been a long time, unless you're flying a city an hour away, that's less than $500.
Yeah. So what's that? 150 million? I don't know. Whatever the number is, I can't do it in my head. It's like a big number, right? So 300,000 times five would be 1.5 million.
No.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah, 160 million.
Sounds right.
320,000, right? Times
500. Yeah.
160 million.
160 million. Where'd that come from?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you go back to that, you think about our supply chain basically in the U.S. is going to grow normally, right? You've had legal immigration, you've had birth rates, you've had people that have come here legally. So you take your grocery shelves, you take our supply chain here. Yes, we supply food to the rest of the world, but you supply and demand. We know during COVID, you had the shutdown, you had supply chain restrictions, which caused and money given to a lot of people to go bid up the price of goods, right? So you think about all this food inflation here. It makes sense to me that if we've got 10 million illegal immigrants coming across that are given, here, go buy a lot of food. Now they're competing with our widows and our orphans and our single moms and our retired individuals that are on a fixed income for that food. And that's further exacerbating the inflationary prices that we're seeing and pressures that we're seeing in food. Makes sense to me.
Sure. All right. So back to this Federal Reserve Act.
Yes.
Skinny little thing. I've read it. And all that the Fed is actually chartered to do, as far as I can tell, is that during certain circumstances, they can offer a punishing rate of interest for high quality collateral to a bank that wants to come to the discount window. And then over time, they became responsible for everything, right? And then they just, I don't know where, it's not written in there that says, oh, the Federal Reserve will be responsible for establishing by committee what the price of money should be.
No.
Which is the original sin in this story, right? Mm-hmm. So they decide for 8 out of the last 12 years, they decided before they started raising interest rate, they decided that money was worth zero. That's it. We need zero rates. So you got zero. We all know this. Everybody listening, you'd go down and like, oh, I'm getting 0.03% on my savings account, right? They decided money was worth zero. And of course, that created all sorts of distortions in all kinds of ways. And nobody, I've looked at it, Paul, there's no official act anywhere that grants them the authority to reward one homeowners at the expense of the upcoming generation, to decide that people should save and get nothing, that their money has zero value for saving. No, but this is what they do now. This is monetary vandalism. This is going to break, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's why people are a little nervous, because they overdid it. And mm-hmm. and I think we all know now in our heart of hearts, like, it's not different this time. The Fed has two choices before it. Print a lot more, which everybody seems to be betting on, and the markets are saying, mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome, right? And, or we have to go through some austerity.
Mm-hmm.
One way or the other, right, we have to pay the bills in this story. Inflation steals from everybody, rewards a few people, so they prefer that one. The alternative is we go down this path where we let the buildings fall down until we discover where the floor support is on this story. And that's where we find out, and this is awkward, the United States is about 30% of all the debt in the whole world is housed in this country.
Yes.
And so that's a big mountain to dig out from under. Either way, it's really painful. But we shouldn't have been here. Markets should have set the interest rates, and we wouldn't have gotten here if we had honest money.
Well, if we'd had individuals that had trusted the free market, right? But the problem is these individuals are so intellectual, they just assume that everybody else is you know, not as smart as they are, can't make as good of decisions as they can, and they forget that everybody, there are individuals even in their poverty that have wisdom beyond the intellectuals that have the greatest degrees that are out there, right? So they want to control this because we know better than everyone else. And then everyone else discovers that they were, you know, very well-dressed fools when it ends. The free market is far better. Two heads are better than one. 10 are better than two. And then a whole society that's out there in a free market, you have this natural flowing that's going to take place, and you're letting the market dictate where things need to go. And these central planners, I mean, central planning has just not worked throughout history. History is littered with all kinds of calamities with governments that you know, think a totalitarian move or a complete communist move. You should go do this career. You should go do that career. It's not going to succeed in the end. And the American people just don't realize or are not courageous enough to realize that's what's taking place right now.
Well, it is, and it is central planning, and it's going to suffer the same fate as all the other central planning. But if I heard you right, Paul, what we should do is to become a member of the Federal Open Market Committee, you have to be able to assemble an IKEA dresser in under 30 minutes. Is that what you're saying?
That works. You're right. If you do it in under 30 minutes, you're good.
You're good. Hey,
and you get a higher level if you can do it without reading the instructions and do it under 30 minutes.
Absolutely. Well, back, you know, I read the original documents around the Federal Reserve because I'm that kind of guy. And the original founding of when they wanted to have this open market committee, it had to, by law, an industrialist, a farmer, like they had to have this other representation on there.
Oh, really?
They don't have that anymore. Yep. That all got stripped away. Now it's just academics, eggheads, abstract thinkers. You know, look at Janet Yellen, former professor, right? Ben Bernanke, former professor. I mean, these are just ivory tower eggheads. And again, we'll give them the IKEA bureau test, but I'm only half kidding. Like, we need people who know, who've used their bodies, used their hands, and know the gap. There's no gap for a blue collar worker between what they do, the decisions they make in reality. Maybe. Those things are, you know, have a relationship. They're just not grounded in reality, you know?
No.
Oh yeah. Let's set interest rates at zero. What's the worst that could happen? Massive distortions
and calamity, right? Just absolute calamity, because you're encouraging people to take on that debt. And I believe that what people forget, and it's in our human nature, because our psychological weaknesses, we'll take what's happened in the most recent past 3 years, and then we project that into the future. And that works to our favor, and that works to our hurt, because sometimes things have been bad for the past 3 years and we assume that they're never going to get better. So they've done this for so long, it's hard for people to actually remember, you know, what happened in 2007, 2008. A friend of mine and I were having a conversation. He was telling his son, he's like, son, you don't understand, you know, you were 4 years old during the 2008 crisis when my electrical company wasn't making any money and we were worried about whether we were going to lose our house. Right. So people forget that. And then debt is just future consumption pulled forward till today, which means in the future you have less ability to consume. And if inflation, which is going to be the great judge in the end, is going to put a limit on the government's ability to print. And if they continue to print, then we're going to end up in a hyperinflationary crisis. And that is evil cast upon the populace.
It is. Albert Bartlett said the greatest shortcoming of the human race is the inability to understand the exponential function. But I have a close second for that, which is our inability to learn from history or remember. So I'm old enough. I've lived through three bubbles. Nobody should live through more than one in an entire generation because it's so painful. It's like, let's not do that again, you know? But how about this, right? So I put this up. Like, you know, that's tulip mania on the left when tulip bulbs went cray-cray in the 1634 to 1637 in Holland. And that's NVIDIA, but it's different this time, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it's insane. And where I realize, Paul, that we've really lost the plot line is that NVIDIA now has a higher market cap than the largest oil company sitting on the largest best oil reserves in the entire world. It has a market cap that's larger. Humans are like, that's worth more to us. We'd much rather have little spinning discs and lights and whirring things and fans and some chips than oil. You know, we value it more highly. It's insane.
That's insane. History. I would say future psychological degrees, when that pendulum swings back to wisdom being pursued, is going to spend a lot of time studying how foolish the decisions that the average leader and even in, participants in the market have made during this period of time. It'll be studied for a long time in history, in the future history.
Well, I'm glad you looked into Europe too, because I've got to get my hands on some German people to interview them, because I'm just shocked that it's an industrial nation, right? Mm-hmm. They built their whole prosperity around being an industrial nation, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we make things, BMWs, we cast engine blocks, borosilicate, you know, foundries, BASF and all their chemicals and all that. And they needed like energy for that. And then the U.S. went and blew up the Nord Stream pipelines, or somebody in NATO did, right? You know, us and somebody else, doesn't matter. Their own allies sabotaged them, right? And then we said, well, don't worry, Germany, trust us. We'll just sell you all this LNG we've got. It's going to be a lot more expensive, but we're good. And then Biden just comes out, his administration's like, we're not going to build any more LNG terminals, right? It's just like, how are they not absolutely in the streets rioting over this? Because basically their entire prosperity took a bullet in each kneecap. And I'm shocked that they would put up with this and why they're not even mildly displeased about what's just gone on. I'm confused.
I am shocked, unless they're just so disconnected from any news of what's actually taken place. But I mean, that has to be felt by the average citizen in Germany. It has to be. I don't see how it wouldn't be. And that's just amazing to me. And especially, they're smart enough to make some of the best machines, right, in the world. Their reputation, I mean, they're excellent at what they do, but yet they can't see the destruction of their wealth generation taking place under their feet. I don't understand that. And another thing I don't understand is, what are investors thinking driving this up to an all-time high? You know, the one thing that concerns me, Chris, is, you know, the thing that concerns me is, are we seeing the, and I think it's got to take more evidence. So I'm not suggesting that this is the case. This is just a thought comes to mind. So this is something to think about. So I don't know that this is the case. Are we seeing the initial steps of hyperinflation taking place around the world? You know, I mean, we don't have enough evidence to say that that's taking place right now, because that's going to require the Fed to really just come up, global monetary presses to take off again. But is that what market participants are thinking? Because it just doesn't make sense to me to be clamoring, you know, panic purchasing assets that are subject to economic cycles in the midst of a recession with the assumption that the Federal Reserve is going to save the day. It just doesn't. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, there's a possibility here, which is, so we've mentioned it before, but we all know that there's huge pain in the commercial real estate space, right? Particularly office space. This is true in Germany as it is here in the United States. And the United States is pretty much across every major market at this stage. So it's pretty bad. So what happens, here's all I can imagine to carry your hypothesis. Market participants, mostly the big players, are thinking, hey, this is just like 2008-09 again. The Fed's going to have to ride in, right? Let's rewind, because people forget about this. This was a calamity. So Hank Paulson rides in to Congress, closed-door session, with a two-page memo the most expensive memo in government history. Says, I need $780 billion or martial law, and there'll be brimstone, and, you know, terrible things will happen, right? And by all, when all was said and done, Bloomberg ended up having to FOIA out of the Federal Reserve. Like they said, how many transactions to swap lines did you conduct as a consequence of that? And the answer was 21 trillion, right? So they were just plugging like crazy. But here's what we know. AIG oversold hundreds of billions of dollars of these credit default swaps. They didn't bother to insure the underlying or even have access to the underlying. They were just writing insurance policies naked. They got caught. And the government wrote in and paid 100 cents on the dollar for those. Now, why did they do that? Why not? They're big boys and girls, right? Hey, Goldman Sachs, so sorry you're on the other side of this trade. Better luck next time. Do your due diligence. Here's 10 cents on the dollar. Punishing discount rates. Nope, 100 cents on the dollar. And that always caught me off guard. I'm like, what? I mean, it's good to be well-connected, but even that's stinky.
Yes.
So I think it's because they knew that if they didn't get all of that, there was this chance that the whole fraud would be exposed. And there was actually a whole lot of shenanigans sitting under that they couldn't risk having it be exposed. So the Fed bought really trash paper and put it on his balance sheet to quietly walk it off. And the government paid 100 cents on the dollar for stuff that happened. I think they think that's going to happen again. Yeah. You look at the $1 trillion of losses coming in commercial real estate plus. And either we let that bubble pop and the pain falls where it will, or the Fed or somebody or the government or whatever, is there a distinction? I don't think so. Has to ride in and pay 100 cents on the dollar. Now, what happens? Well, first, the money that you put out in the first place, it's still out in the system. And then you have to buy back that crap paper for 100 cents on the dollar. That's another tranche of money that goes out there. Two units of money for one failed asset, right? It's going to be astonishing. So I think you could be right that that's what's being scented here, is the idea that there's a big old round of printing coming, and maybe that's what gold is telling us.
Right. Yeah. The breakout in gold, that's something that I watched it and I'm like, is this really taking place? Like, I want to see this stay there a week or two, but that's actually a really big deal. Okay. It's a really big deal that we've broken out of that price range with gold, especially when we've got a strong dollar right now and we have disinflation, you know, taking place in various sectors of the economy. So gold's price action has been very encouraging, and it's a pretty big deal, both from a technical standpoint and a long-term indication of where the price can go. I don't think there's going to necessarily be a tremendous amount of instant gratification. There may be, though, because we've got that tends to happen when you have breakouts take place that occur like this.
Yeah. So 2150 here ish. This is year to date. Let's max this out. But you can clearly see this. We've talked about this before, this cup and handle, but it's a pretty clear breakout. And it's fascinating that it's happening right now. And it's happening. This is the fun part. It's happening with almost no retail participation. It's bizarre. They've done such a good job hammering on gold over the years, Paul, that like, I kid you not, I can talk to my lawn guy, I can talk to the car guy, I can talk to regular, ordinary, working-class folks, and they will talk to me about Bitcoin. Nobody talks to me about gold. Nobody.
No.
Which means it has a lot more to run.
It does.
That's how I always...
Well, I'll tell you what's interesting. So, especially in the local area in the North Georgia community, I'm vocal because I've shared the same recommendation that gold is like fire insurance against inflation on your portfolio and chaos insurance, right? And we've talked about that before, but just for new listeners that are out there, one of the reasons I like gold as an insurance policy on your portfolio is if you take 10% of what you have in cash and cash equivalents and you purchase gold with it, you want to set it on the shelf, and ideally 10 years from now, it's going to be the same price that it is today. And you got to think of it like fire insurance on your home, right? Like, I pay fire insurance, you do. I mean, it's a risk that you have to cover, but nobody sits there 10 years from now and says, well, geez, I wish my house had burnt down. I wasted $30,000 over the past 10 years on insurance. So gold is something that needs to be there. But we also, during periods of time, will invest in the gold, and have been for quite some time. So when I go around town, you know, there's a lot of individuals, they'll be like, hey, how's gold doing? Or, you know, what's taking place? So just in the past couple of days, gold broke out to new time highs. I had a couple of people at the local retail store make the comment, says, I sold some gold and I took some profits because there's no way it's going to break out and go. And I'm thinking, okay, you're one of those individuals that owns it. And you're so believing, you know, that's what happens in bear markets, right? You believe that it's never going to take off again. And so you're right. There's not sentiment. I remember 2012 with even on a local level, if I'd have taken every person that called to buy gold, you know, the first time we got to 1900 an ounce, 1900 an ounce, I could have had a line of 150 people around the corner. I haven't had one phone call outside of really educated individuals. And that's the minority that has said, hey, should we do something with gold? Not one. I've had all kinds of phone calls over in NVIDIA and, you know, what to do with that.
So, this is a standard size tube, right? This will hold 20 coins. It's got a little silver in it right now. But if this had gold in it at 2,100 an ounce times 20, so this would be what? 44,000 ish, something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really like, are you kidding me? Like,
no.
What? When I was growing up, right, you know, that was a college education plus a house down payment, you know, but it's astonishing, you know. And so here's my theory on this. Gold is going up because there's more buyers than sellers. Who's doing the buy-in? This has to be official buying at this point in time, because we're not seeing it on the retail side all that much. I call the coin people and they're like, well, you know, it's, you know, we got some buying, but it's not like it is during times when retail's really stepped in. It's not that. So it's institutions. Now, this would, a.k.a. the smart money. Some of this, Paul, is central banks who, by the way, are really unhappy with the fact that think what you will about Russia, I don't care. But for the United States to have taken their sovereign reserves and seized gold and digital paper assets was a bad sign. And a lot of countries understood correctly, like, wow, I'm exposed. Either the United States can just freeze me out, or, you know what, I'll have gold here at home. Plus, they've also, according to this Invesco survey that came out a while ago, the central banks have also thrown in the towel and said, I think inflation's kind of entrenched in here to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And once they believe that, there's more compelling reason to hold gold. So I actually think the buying pressure we're seeing is coming from two places, China and China retail. And that there's a lot of stories about China retail going hard on this, and official central banks. But it's been pretty quiet, but it's been happening.
Yes. Well, and my concern is we've continually seen over the past 15 years with gold prices down, let's say 10 years with an acceleration, is gold has left the U.S. and gone overseas. Okay. And Chris, I don't believe that gold's ever going to be able to come back to the U.S. because the U.S. investor is not going to be able to afford to buy it back by the time they realize that they need to. So, and then, you know, another wild card is, I'm trying to remember the exact details, but, you know, if you're a country doing business with China, they have a special yuan for those country business exchanges back and forth that could be converted to gold. Well, I mean, you know, if you're in any way under the crosshairs of the U.S. and their weaponization of the SWIFT banking system and all of these sanctions that are out there, that's much more attractive. So there's so many reasons that these institutions and countries and Federal Reserves need to own gold right now. And the average individual, especially the U.S. citizen, is just like, my, that's boring. And Wall Street, your average Wall Street individual, I mean, there are firms out there that will not compensate the advisors if they're, I say firms, I know of a firm, you know, major brokerage warehouse that won't compensate their advisors if they purchase gold. So that's if their clients purchase gold. So there's all kinds of incentives on Wall Street to stay away from gold because it doesn't have a bunch of internal expenses and fees that they're going to generate off of it.
Sure. Now, gold, let's be clear about this, because it's, you know, I'm a gold bug. Been there for a while, but I believe in it because it takes energy to get it out of the ground. By the time you have a 1 ounce piece of gold, it's astonishing how much energy is actually involved in that. So if this is a newly minted ounce of gold from a mine that just came out, think about a pile of rock probably about the size of your car or an SUV that had to be ripped out of the ground, smashed down to like a powder, leached, refined, separated from the base metals and stamped and delivered to get it to you. I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary amount of work involved in that. And then once it's in that form, You know what's going to happen to that for the next 10,000 years? Nothing.
Nothing.
Like gold is like this, it's this permanent substance. Like it just mm-hmm. sits there, right? You can put it in the ocean, which ruins everything. Mm-hmm. That is still gold, right? So we have all that going on, but it's the only monetary asset. It's a tier one Basel Accord asset. Mm-hmm. It's as good as treasuries, right? It's the only financial asset I know about, Paul, that isn't somebody else's liability.
Yes. And that's the great thing about gold. So I had a debate with someone a couple of months ago. Well, and this is a debate that happens like, well, what if we have another Great Depression? You know, should I own gold because it's going to go down in value? And I said, well, yes, it's going to go down in value, but it's going to maintain the purchasing power in deflation that you have today. What everything else may not do, right, is let's say the utility company. So in the South, it's Southern Company, which is Georgia Power and some of the others. They have a lot of debt. I mean, responsible debt, but they have a lot of debt because of all the infrastructure they have to keep up with. So if you had deflation enough, theoretically, I'm not saying this will happen, guys. Don't take it out of context. But theoretically, Southern Company could go bankrupt and somebody else would step in and take it over. So, you know, theoretically, our government could go bankrupt. So the safest asset, because it has no debtor behind it, there's no one that can confiscate that from you if you have it in your possession, is gold. And it does retain its value. Throughout history, it's been a consistent monetary medium of exchange.
Yep. And you mentioned if the government goes bankrupt, people say, oh, they can't. They have a printing press. Actually, the government does not have a printing press.
Right.
Not the electronic one. That belongs to the Federal Reserve, which, let me endeavor to point this out, is a private cartel. It's not mm-hmm. owned by citizens. It's owned as capital stock outstanding. It's owned by other banks. It's not actually a U.S. government thing. It gets its power and authority through an act that was passed by Congress, could be revoked, I guess, but in a pinch, right? Let's think this through. So how could the government go bankrupt? Mm-hmm. Well, that's weird. You know, we got tax receipts, The U.S. government has so much debt outstanding right now, $34 trillion, as we mentioned, going up $1 trillion every 100 days. So it's climbing all the time, even as we speak. And because in their infinite wisdom, like dispensing with the New England Northeast Gas Reserve, they've decided to put this on the short-term credit card. So this is a lot of short-term paper, all of which comes together that this year, this calendar year, the government's going to have to roll $10 trillion of debt. Right. So they roll it. Right. I have a 28 day, you know, treasury bill coming due. I put it out. I roll another 28 days. So but if for whatever reason the system was like, I don't trust you guys anymore at this rate of interest, you're going to have to give me a higher rate of interest to compensate me for the risk I'm taking lending you this deadbeat country money. What do you got? That's where we find out it's really hard to roll 10 trillion when people don't show up at your auction. So this whole thing has to keep moving somehow, right? I just want to paint, that's how it could happen, is if you had a failed auction, if suddenly mm-hmm. you had to roll $150 billion this week and nobody showed up or you only got half there, you have a problem on your hands.
Yes, yes. So, and the good thing about gold is, yeah, even if it goes from 2,000 to 1,000, but the cost of everything goes down 50%, you don't have to worry about losing it to bankruptcy and somebody else taking that asset from you. You go exchange it and it'll purchase the same amount of cans of Campbell's soup, theoretically, at a lower price as it will if they're at a higher price. So not that it's the perfect, you know, hedge, but when you get extremes one way or another, it really is kind of the perfect hedge, because if you have a major deflationary event, you don't have to worry about losing that asset, right? So if you're in the wrong bank and you're over FDIC limits, let's say you got $1 million in your local bank and you fully believe that the government's going to bail out the bank just like they did Silicon Valley Bank, right? So FDIC insurance is a waste. I just don't believe that the government's going to allow that to happen. Well, if the only thing they cover is FDIC insurance, then you're out $750,000 for that one individual, right? Where you're not out if you have that gold. Price goes down, and yeah, theoretically your purchasing power went down in that case, but if purchasing power goes down 50%, you know, you're still better off to hold that gold that goes from 2,000 to 1,000 than you are that count that went from 1 million to 250. So, you know, it is a good asset. What it's not a good asset in, during periods of time that it's not a good asset is when you have basically no inflation, no chaos. We're back to a normal market environment. Mm-hmm. Let's say the market drops 70%. We get back to historically good valuations. On the other side of that, I would want to reduce my holdings and deploy it into other capital because we're back to a long-term foundation that we can build from. But when you're at this extreme, when something's close to breaking, it's a prudent asset to have as insurance in the portfolio. And if you think of it that way, that gives you the mental capability to take a portion of your assets, set it aside, and put it on the shelf and hope that it doesn't go higher. But if it does, it'll be one of the best decisions that you ever made. Not a recommendation. We're just having conversations. Mm-hmm. You got to talk to your financial advisor before you make that decision. So I got that out of the way. Good.
There. Good. Well, Paul, where I would have a hard thought that I would have to push through in my own head is what interest rate would actually attract me away from what would cause me to sell my gold and get attracted to it. And for me, currently, the answer is treasuries at about 10%, right? There, I think I have to start under current environment, right? I have to start making a decision. Now, obviously, by the time we get to a 10% rate of interest, it'll be a whole different landscape. And at that time, I might be thinking, now I need 20%, right? So I'm not sure I'll ever get there, you know?
I was going to challenge you a little bit. I'm like, Chris, I don't know about 10%. That makes me nervous.
All things being equal, ceteris paribus, right?
Right.
Like today. All things being today, equal,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
I'd have to think it through. It's just not attractive at current rate. I'm perfectly happy sitting where I am right now.
Right. And it's nice to be rewarded for those investors that have owned it the correct way, right? Not a panic purchase, not a panic sell, but to seriously sit down and think about, okay, what can this do for me? And how does this investment asset work as a tool in my portfolio? I think if people really considered how different assets work as a tool in their portfolio, and there are some investments that, especially when you look at the energy space, you've done such a good job of educating people about the problems that we're going to have in energy down the road. Well, right? Well, a constricted supply in a world that has to have energy means prices are going to go up. So for the patient investor, those are some of the most undervalued investments in the market right now because big institutions don't want to own them because of, you know, whatever legislation is being pushed down over the top. We're starting to see problems in the electric vehicle market right now. It's not the solution and there's not the demand out there that there was expected to be, that the market euphoria was expected to be. So there are certain assets that this is a tool that I'm going to set aside and be patient. And then there's other assets in your portfolio that you have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon you, but you have your exit plan ready, right? Like there's so many people in NVIDIA right now. My concern is I have no clue when it's going to end, but my concern is that's going to be a very narrow door for a lot of people to try to exit out of when the inevitable disappointment occurs. And at some point in the future, we're going to get a disappointment. No different than the tulip bubble that occurred in the past. That was a perfect overlay. I mean, you can see the psychological behavior in those charts, and it's going to end the same. You just don't know how much higher it goes before it's over.
Yep. Agreed. So as you cast about, anything special on your radar right now that you want to talk about? Anything that's in the markets that has made you, things that make you go,
The things that make me go, So my base thesis right now, and I reserved the right to change my mind, so nobody make any investment decisions off of this. We've got a lot of euphoria that's kind of taking place here in the short run. There's something for everyone. The cryptocurrency prices have broken out. Like my son called me the other day. He's like, Dad, you know, Dogecoin finally took off again. And I'm like, because, you know, he bought it at a terrible time and it dropped. I said, buy you some more money you're willing to lose. And he's so excited that he added some more to it. And I said, okay, now's the time to start averaging out a little bit. But something for everyone. You've got the cryptos, you've got precious metals breaking out. I really like kind of some of the action that I'm seeing in the miner stocks right now, right? So as gold prices go up, those look good. You've got tech stocks that are booming. You've got world index that are an all-time high. There's a little bit of something for everyone. And I'm expecting that we're probably closer to a correction here in the short run than we are the final blow off top. So my expectation would be that we get a correction here in the short run, and then we don't see the final euphoria until the summer. So that's just kind of an educated guess is what I see take place right now. This reminds me of spring of 2000. Now, my tools are telling me that, hey, maybe the market will continue to go. This is a period of time you need to be cautious in. But this is very reminiscent of the 2000 kind of market peak in the spring, where you had a lot of volatility and action back and forth. You had a couple of all-time highs, and then you rolled over a little bit later. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a decent little correction to take some of this excess euphoria out of the market here in the short run. And from my standpoint, not a recommendation to anybody out there, you know, you've got a breakout in gold. Yeah, it could be a false breakout. But if you do have a pullback in the short run, just because it gets sucked into that across the board, because we finally broke out of that price level, that's a big deal. That's an opportunity to be able to acquire some if it's appropriate for your situation.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, my is watching the current President Biden, obviously struggling with infirmity and the whole machinery trying to pretend like there's nothing wrong here. So it's a very awkward moment, right? Because there's obviously issues. All the polling is coming back saying, wow, he just gets trounced, right? There was a straw poll held recently where he lost to a guy nobody'd ever heard of, right? In a state, right? So some guy threw his name on there, I guess. I mean, probably there's more to it than that, but I had never heard of this guy. I was like, there's going to have to be some, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty around this particular election. I don't think the markets aren't pricing in any uncertainty, no volatility. It's priced for perfection right now. And I'm like, I see some imperfections coming along here. Right. Every bubble's in search of a pin, you know, so I'm in retrospect, it's always obvious. Oh, it was that moment where that person said that one thing, the Archduke got shot, right? You know,
right. We'll find that. But that's a good point. I mean, that, you know, leading into that, that's the reason why I think by the time we get to the summer, if it lasts that long, all of a sudden the market's going to start looking to the election, right? And then it's going to be, okay, what are we going to get? Who are we going to get? How much contention is going to be there? Or are there going to be any wild cards? You know, that's when I'm concerned that things could really start to come apart if they haven't by then already. But this momentum is pretty strong. So my anticipation is we get a correction here in the short run. But the reality is this is a period of time when you look at this that it's prudent. If your debt levels are too high, and you've got some stocks like NVIDIA that have done really, really good. Not a recommendation because I don't know your situation, but it is a prudent thing in general just to sweep some of that off the top, because you're not going to pick the top, right? And in hindsight, if you put yourself in a better financial position with a strong foundation, with all of the risks that we have over just between now and the election, not counting what's over the next 24 months, potential real recession setting in once the energy and effort to prop things up into the election is over, right? Then we may see the reality following that as to what's really taking place under the economy, because whoever the new president is doesn't really have a reason to be trying to prop the markets up until the next election cycle.
Right, right. Well said. Well, that's why I love working with you, Paul, because you want to do the right things for people. So I like that idea of think about deleveraging if you're in one of those high leverage situations right now. And thinking back to that chart, I know some of the people listening to this, their non-mortgage interest costs are climbing and they're up there. And because, listen, that's a big chart and we're all part of that. So, this is it's not different this time. I think it's always the same.
It's not. I was trying so hard to come up with something very witty and snarky to say, and the only thing that I could come up with, I really couldn't say. So I was stumbling on that first question.
Yeah. Well, for anybody listening, if you want to work with Paul and his team, and they're just fabulous, please come to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form. Paul and his team will get back to you. And Paul, thanks so much for your time again today. It's always a wonderful conversation.
Always great. Thanks for the work you do, Chris. And it's always an honor to talk to you.
Hello, Chris Martinson. I'm the CEO of Peak Prosperity and also Peak Financial Investing. And after watching that, you're probably wondering, well, what do I do with my money? Look, you both deserve and need somebody who can talk to you about what's really going on in this world, understand the situation as it is, not be steering you towards certain things that don't make sense for you or just keep you in a game that's already ended. Look, if you want to talk to somebody about the petrodollar declining, or what is happening with gold, or which sectors are actually the best ones to be in, given what the Federal Reserve is up to or the federal government, you deserve to talk to somebody who can answer those and has a few gray hairs and has been there through some of the economic cycles because, hey, we're in another economic cycle, so it's good to have that experience. Fortunately, at Peak Financial Investing, what we do is we go out and we scour and we look for the very best firms out there who satisfy one thing above all else. They've got great experience coupled to great customer service. So if you want to come by peakfinancialinvesting.com, there's a very simple form you can fill out, just a few fields. You hit send. What happens is an email gets triggered out. It goes to an endorsed firm of ours. You will get an email back. You can then set up a phone call for a 30 to 45 minute free, no obligation, no pressure call to find out if this firm is a good fit for you and to find out if you're a good fit for the firm. It has to go both ways. And if all that matches up, this will be one of the best things that could happen to you this year. So please come by peakfinancialinvesting.com. Very simple process. We would love to help you if we can. Thanks very much.